Tuesday, June 20th, 2006. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Becca Bartleson.
This is the KBOO Morning News. The Federal Emergency Commission has accepted Northstar Natural Gas's application to build a liquefied natural gas facility near Astoria. The bodies of two American soldiers missing in Iraq have been found, and Japan is pulling its 602 troops out of Iraq. Portland area weather today, patchy morning clouds and then mostly clear for the rest of the day with temperatures getting to almost 80. Tonight, cloudy along the coast, mostly clear inland with temperatures around 50.
The U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has formally accepted Northern Star Natural Gas application to build a liquefied natural gas terminal on the Columbia River at Bradwood. Next, there will be a three-week period for citizens to file in protest or as official stakeholders in the case. This from the Daily Astorian. The commission, which has the ultimate decision on whether to site an LNG terminal almost 40 miles east of Astoria, gave the public notice Friday, roughly 1 week after the Houston-based company filed applications to build the facility and install a pipeline to deliver the gas. Northern Star executives referred to the advance as clearing another major milestone. Some community members weren't as pleased about the progress, and several people have voiced concern about a lack of transparency in the process for siting LNG facilities. Northern Star did not provide preliminary filing information to at least one person who requested it, and last week the U.S. Coast Guard refused to release any part of the project's waterway suitability assessment, an analysis of whether the 600-foot-wide Columbia River can accommodate liquefied natural gas tankers while still meeting safety and security regulations. However, the company has posted resource reports containing some of this information online.
Georgia Pacific's chemical plant in Albany has been admitted into a federal government program for corporations that exceed regulatory requirements. The Environmental Protection Agency's National Environmental Performance Track, or NEPT, is a volunteer partnership that rewards facilities for their environmental efforts and community involvement. Members receive regulatory and administrative benefits and are rated with a low priority for routine inspections. The program started in 2000, has almost 400 members nationwide. This is the fifth facility in the country to join NEPT and the eighth member plant in Oregon. Georgia Pacific's Albany Chemical Plant makes specialty resins and other chemicals used to make plywood, hardboard, and medium-density fiberboard. This from the Oregonian.
The Senate unanimously approved a bill to revamp management of the nation's marine fisheries and strengthen protections against overfishing of dwindling stocks. The bill requires the use of annual catch limits and enhances the authority of eight regional fishery management councils as Congress works to protect vulnerable fish stocks while keeping struggling fishing industries afloat. The sweeping bill reauthorizes the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act, the 30-year-old law that oversees fishery management in waters between 3 miles and 200 miles offshore. The bill also would bolster the role of scientific advisory committees and incorporate several recommendations from the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy, which has called for an overhaul of U.S. ocean policies and laws. Democratic Senators Ron Wyden of Oregon and Barbara Boxer of California dropped their opposition after Senate leaders agreed to a provision making West Coast salmon fishermen eligible for disaster assistance.
During numerous spring rallies, Oregon Hispanic advocates joined a national push to register 1 million new voters across the country before the November elections in hopes that the contentious immigration issue will mobilize a sector that often doesn't cast ballots. It includes a push to get millions of eligible residents to apply for citizenship so they can vote later, if not this year. On the heels of huge rallies, the immigration rights movement is preparing for workshops in July and the next big rally on Labor Day. Oregon's Farm Workers Union, the Woodburn-based Tree Planters and Farm Workers of the Northwest United, or PCUN, also is taking part. Data from the Department of Homeland Security indicate that interest in citizenship is rising. The national We Are America Alliance, which formed in May, will begin its Democracy Summer on July 1st in Oregon with a series of community forums to tell people how to go about voting, to educate them about citizenship application scams, and to talk about pending legislation. Nationally, the plan is to expand the Hispanic voter pool by getting more eligible people to apply for citizenship. This is from the Oregonian.
State and federal wildlife biologists will test wild birds in Oregon this summer and fall as part of a nationwide effort to aim at early detection of the bird flu virus. Sampling will focus on several species of migratory shorebirds and waterfowl that are most likely to have interacted with birds from Asia while in the Arctic this summer. Live birds, hunter-harvested birds, and fecal matter will be tested. This from the Oregonian.
The day after Tim Iman's referendum bid fizzled, hundreds of supporters of Washington's new gay rights law gathered in downtown Seattle to celebrate the protections taking effect. Evangelical churches strongly opposed to the law, which bars discrimination against gays and lesbians in housing, employment, insurance, and credit, are weighing other political options. After referendum 65 failed to get enough signatures to qualify for the November ballot, Randall said his group looked into launching an initiative to the people. That option was ruled out because they didn't think they could get the nearly 500,000 required signatures by the July 7th deadline. It's too late for another referendum, which must be filed within 90 days of the end of the legislative session in which a law was passed. But the deadline for an initiative to the legislature isn't until December 29th. The state's highest court may rule later this year on the constitutionality of same-sex marriage, and Washington could become the second state after Massachusetts to allow same-sex marriage if the court throws out the state's 1998 Defense of Marriage Act, which limits marriage to heterosexual couples.
A Fort Lewis soldier has been ordered held on $50,000 bail, accused of making a date over the internet to have sex with a 13-year-old girl. The online girl was really a Thurston County Sheriff's detective conducting a sting operation. Frederick Wells was arrested last Friday and booked at Thurston County Jail. The sheriff's detective posing as a girl had signed off her computer by 3:03 p.m. Thursday. Wells reached their planned meeting spot by 4 p.m., Erickson Muldrew said. Wells was being held on suspicion of attempted second-degree child rape, attempted first-degree kidnapping with sexual motivation, and communicating with a minor for immoral purposes.
A woman in the suburb north of Vancouver had reason to feel like Goldilocks in reverse when she arrived home to find a bear eating her oatmeal in her kitchen. The 1 or 2 year old juvenile bear apparently entered through an open sliding glass door, broke a ceramic food container, and started chowing down last week. Three police officers couldn't get the bear to budge. Police said the bear didn't appear to be aggressive and wasn't destroying the house, so they just let it do what it was doing, and eventually the bear decided to make its way out of the residence and down towards a forested gully. It ended the best it could. The report was one of 6 complaints police said they received about bears in the area.
The Supreme Court ruled yesterday that the government can block development on hundreds of millions of acres of wetlands, even on land miles away from waterways, as long as regulators prove a significant connection to the waterways. Chief Justice John Roberts, in his first major environmental case, came up one vote short of dramatically limiting the scope of the landmark Clean Water Act. At the same time, property rights advocates won a new test for when wetlands can be regulated. Moderate Justice Anthony M. Kennedy said there must be a significant nexus between the wetland and a navigable waterway. Virtually any land in America would be covered under the government's interpretation of the law, Roberts and the court's other 3 conservatives complained in an opinion. The court's 4 liberal members said the conservatives would have opened up sensitive wetlands to polluters. It was a dramatic conclusion to a pair of property rights cases the justices agreed to review last fall, just days after Roberts joined the court. The Bush administration defended the law and had urged the court to stay out of the case.
Fierce election year debate on Iraq spilled over into a second week on Capitol Hill, with Senate Democrats lining up behind a proposal to start U.S. troop withdrawals this year, and Republicans chastising them for espousing a cut-and-run strategy. In what Republicans and Democrats alike are billing as perhaps the Senate's largest debate on Iraq since war began in spring of 2003, the Senate is to take up the resolution today and vote on it sometime this week. The debate comes a week after the GOP-controlled Senate and House soundly rejected timetables for pulling U.S. forces out of Iraq. Back-to-back votes that forced lawmakers in both parties to go on record on the issue less than 5 months before midterm elections. As the U.S. debt toll and war spending continue to climb, polls show the public increasingly uncomfortable with the direction of the conflict. Democrats in Congress have long been split over the way ahead in Iraq, and Republicans have sought to highlight those divisions in recent weeks. In control of Congress, the GOP is seeking a political advantage as recent polls show the public favor Democrats to run the House and Senate.
The chairman of the House Resources Committee and a Florida lawmaker have reached a compromise on offshore oil drilling, increasing the likelihood of a House approval. Even if the compromise passes the House, however, it is expected to run into strong opposition and almost certain filibuster in the Senate. Republican Resources Chairman Richard Pombo worked out details of the compromise over the weekend with Republican Representative Adam Putnam of Florida. None of this is good news for the environment. The legislation, expected to be taken up for a vote by Pombo's committee tomorrow, would give states the right to opt out of a federal moratorium on oil and gas drilling at least 50 miles from shore. It also would permanently protect a state, such as Florida, from oil and gas development within 100 miles if it chooses not to seek an exemption from the federal drilling ban. There has been growing interest in lifting the federal offshore drilling restrictions to gain access to more domestic natural gas and crude oil. Most of the offshore waters outside the western Gulf of Mexico are under drilling moratorium.
The Supreme Court ruled yesterday that statements made by crime victims to 911 operators or police during emergencies can be used in court even if those victims do not testify at trial. By a 9-0 vote, justices ruled that a Washington man's right to confront his accuser was not violated because he could not cross-examine his ex-girlfriend, who claimed in a 911 call that he had assaulted her. In another case out of Indiana, the justices ruled 8-1 that a police officer had crossed the line from dealing with an emergency to conducting an investigation when he questioned a woman about what her husband had done to her well after she had been assaulted. By affirming the Washington man's conviction and reversing the Indiana man's, however, the justices opened the door for prosecutors and police to gather evidence to show that batterers intimidated their victims into silence and forfeited their rights to confront their accusers in court. Writing for the majority, Justice Scalia said 911 statements are admissible in court when police are trying to deal with an emergency, but such statements cannot be used if the emergency has ended and the police are gathering evidence to use in filing criminal charges, he said. In court filings, several women's advocacy groups argued that domestic violence cases are difficult to prosecute because victims are so fearful and that judges need to be more flexible in allowing evidence of abuse.
The alarm sounded by scientists about global warming has deep implications for the insurance industry and consumers, according to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Businesses and governments can do more to reduce carbon dioxide, promote renewable resources, and take other environmentally friendly actions that would benefit the world as well as their bottom line, corporate executives and politicians said. Dramatic climate changes have the potential to affect nearly all segments of insurance coverage, including agricultural, health, life, and business, said Andrew Logan, program manager of Ceres, a Boston-based national network of investment funds, environmental organizations, and other public interest groups. Natural and man-made catastrophic events have steadily increased since 1970, with 8 of the 10 most expensive disasters in U.S. history occurring in the past 4 years, he said. New insurance models predict significantly higher losses in the next 5 years. Primary insurers have been relatively silent on the issue of global warming.
Acting at the mayor's request, Louisiana's Governor Kathleen Blanco said she would send National Guard troops and state police to patrol the streets of New Orleans after a bloody weekend in which 6 people were killed. The governor did not specify how many troops and officers she planned to deploy. Earlier Monday, Mayor Ray Nagin asked for as many as 300 National Guardsmen and 60 state police officers. It was the first time the National Guard has been used for law enforcement in the United States since the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Nagin had sought the troops after 5 teenagers in an SUV were shot and killed in the city's deadliest attack in at least 11 years. Police said the attack was apparently motivated by drugs or revenge, and also a man was stabbed to death Sunday night in an argument over beer. Nagin said he would not allow criminals to take over when the city is still trying to recover from the hurricane, and said troops should be posted in heavily flooded neighborhoods to free police to concentrate on hot spots elsewhere. Community leaders have raised fears that the violence could discourage people from moving back to New Orleans.
A new report claims that a shadow government of federal contractors has exploded in size over the last 5 years. The document, compiled at the request of Democratic Representative Henry Waxman, indicates that procurement spending increased by over $175 billion between 2000 and 2005, making federal contracts the fastest-growing component of federal discretionary spending. That spending increase, an astonishing 86%, puts total U.S. federal procurement at nearly $400 billion annually. The increase means spending on federal contracts has grown more than two times as fast as other forms of discretionary government spending. Waxman claims that overcharging, by mistake or outright fraud, has been a frequent occurrence. Each of the Bush administration's three signature initiatives, Homeland Security, the Iraq War and Reconstruction in Iraq, and Hurricane Katrina recovery, has been linked to wasteful contract spending. But the fastest-growing contractor under the Bush administration has been Halliburton. Federal spending on Halliburton contracts shot up an astonishing 600% between 2000 and 2005.
And the first major call-up of National Guard reservists from rural Alaska since World War II could mean sacrifice and upheaval for Eskimo villages that practice subsistence hunting and gathering in some of the most remote and unforgiving spots in the nation. Eric Phillips' job in the small Yupik Eskimo village of Kongiganak in southwestern Alaska is to hunt walrus, seal, mink, otter, geese, ducks, and other animals to provide food for his immediate family and other relatives. With Phillips shipping out, his wife and their two young sons will be moving to the city of Bethel, about 70 miles away. Similar stories are being told in Eskimo villages across a vast state in places with names like Alakanuk, Emonak, and Monatak, as 670 soldiers for some of the most hard-to-reach places in the nation head to Iraq and Afghanistan. Six men headed to Iraq are from Skamona Bay, a Yupik Eskimo village of about 520 people in western Alaska, where residents rely mostly on subsistence hunting and fishing. Families left behind will now rely more on each other, another time-honored tradition in rural Alaska. The village will take care of them.
According to The Guardian, voters will have the final say on South Dakota's tough new law that bans almost all abortions. Secretary of State Chris Nelson said yesterday that the law's opponents have collected enough signatures to put a question on the November 7th ballot asking voters if the law should go into effect as planned or be dumped. The state's abortion law, among the strictest in the nation, bans the procedure in all cases except when necessary to save a woman's life, with no exceptions for rape or incest. Supporters hoped it would prompt a court challenge that would give the U.S. Supreme Court an opportunity to overthrow its 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion. Instead of challenging it in court, opponents, who argue the law is too extreme, gathered enough petition signatures to put the question directly to voters.
North Korea asserted it has full autonomy to conduct missile tests, and outsiders do not have the right to criticize its plans, Japan's Kyoto News Agency reports today. Before the latest statement, North Korea's apparent moves toward test launching a long-range ballistic missile already spiked tensions in the region and drew warnings of serious repercussions from the United States and others. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan urged North Korean leaders to listen and hear what the world is saying. Earlier today, North Korea lashed out at the United States over its plan to build a missile defense shield, but did not directly address concerns that it was preparing to test fire a missile capable of reaching the United States. There were conflicting reports about whether a missile launch was imminent.
President Bush told Iran yesterday that nations worldwide won't back down from their demand that Tehran suspend uranium enrichment. During a commencement speech at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, Bush said, if Iran's leaders reject his offer, they will face action before the U.N. Security Council and progressively stronger political and economic sanctions. Bush discussed Iran with Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday as well. On Sunday, Iran accused the United States of trying to sway European nations from a possible compromise. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. insistence that negotiations be conditioned on Tehran's suspension of uranium enrichment has narrowed the scope of possible solutions and made it more difficult for all parties to reach an accord. Bush made it clear he would not budge. He said allowing Iran to enrich uranium, a process that can make nuclear fuel or a power plant or fissile material for an atomic bomb, would present a grave threat to the world. Bush's offers on Iran to suspend, not permanently halt, uranium enrichment as a condition for the start of talks, although the negotiations are aimed at getting Iran to agree to a long-term moratorium on such activity.
And the U.S. military in Iraq says the bodies of two American soldiers have been found near where the two, including one from Oregon, disappeared, but that there have been no identifications made. The two who are missing are 25-year-old Private First Class Thomas Tucker of Madras and 23-year-old Christina Menchaca of Houston. The Sunni region where the two disappeared on Friday is known for ambushes of American and Iraqi troops. Yesterday, an umbrella group that includes al-Qaeda in Iraq claimed it had kidnapped two soldiers, but did not name them. An intense weekend search turned up nothing.
Japan ordered the withdrawal of its ground troops from Iraq today. Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi declared the humanitarian mission a success. Koizumi said the 600 non-combat troops deployed in early 2004 had helped rebuild infrastructure to the area where they were based. He pledged further aid to Iraqi reconstruction. Koizumi has been a vocal supporter of U.S. policy in Iraq, arguing that the deployment was needed to aid reconstruction, secure oil supplies, and bolster ties with Washington. The operation constituted Japan's largest and most dangerous overseas military mission since the end of World War II. While concerns for the troops' safety were high, the region they were based in was relatively peaceful. As security deteriorated, they were largely confined to their base. The move to withdraw followed the announcement yesterday that Britain and Australia would hand over responsibility for security to Iraqi forces in southern Mutana province, where the Japanese troops are based. That apparently was a signal to Tokyo that it was time to go. Japan has been concerned that its troops could be drawn into the fighting in Iraq.
The U.S. Army has charged three soldiers in connection with the deaths of three Iraqis who were in military custody in northern Iraq last month. The multinational corps Iraq said three members of the 3rd Brigade Combat Team, 101st Airborne Division, have been charged in connection with the deaths of three male detainees during an operation near Tharthar Canal in northern Salahuddin province on May 9th. It said that a criminal investigation began May 17th and was ongoing. Once charged, defendants have the right to an Article 32 hearing, the military equivalent of a grand jury investigation. Last week, the Army said it had opened a criminal investigation into the suspicious deaths of three men in military custody. The investigation was requested by Lieutenant General Peter Cirelli, commander of the multinational forces in Iraq, who acted after other soldiers raised suspicions about the deaths.
An EU envoy is suggesting that Palestinians could begin to receive direct emergency aid by the beginning of July, according to the BBC. Benita Ferralo-Waldner briefed Israel's foreign ministry on the temporary mechanism allowed to flow of aid. Under terms agreed by the Quartet of Middle East peace brokers, the EU will give 100 million euros, but will bypass the Hamas-led Palestinian government. Western aid was frozen after Hamas won elections but refused to renounce violence or recognize Israel.
Thousands of expert politicians, slum dwellers, and activists are meeting in Vancouver, British Columbia, hoping to plan a way forward for the world's growing cities. The World Urban Forum will discuss ways to make city life sustainable against a backdrop of rising urban populations. United Nations estimates suggest more than half of the world's people will live in urban areas by the end of 2007. With about a third of the city dwellers living in slums, urban poverty is high on the agenda at the five-day forum. The meeting opened with a lavish ceremony featuring drumming and chanting from Canadian Aboriginal people, and a crowd of thousands watched and listened as to a warning that many poor people flock to cities in the hope of a better life, but find conditions worse than where they had been. UN estimates suggest that two-thirds of the world's population will live in cities within 50 years. Ahead of the forum, UN Habitat also released a report detailing the number of city dwellers who live in slum districts, now thought to make up one-third of the world's urban population. Already, rapid growth means an estimated 180,000 people are being added to the world's urban population each day.
An ambitious project to safeguard future food supplies began yesterday with the launch of Noah's Ark for the world's most important plants. Norway's agricultural minister said the new international seed vault will serve as a repository for crucial seeds in the event of a global catastrophe. Carved into the permafrost and rock of the remote Svalbard Peninsula, it will eventually house seed samples from every country in the world. Agricultural relies on collections of crop species and their wild relatives. Seed banks are vital to the development of new crop varieties, and without them, agriculture would grind to the halt. Sample of the world's agricultural biodiversity, including crops such as wheat, apple, and potato, are scattered across 1,400 seed banks around the world. The new seed bank will store its samples in a reinforced concrete tunnel drilled 230 feet into a mountain and guarded by two steel doors and remote controlled from Sweden. The seeds will be stored in foil packets at minus 18 degrees Celsius and are expected to remain viable for thousands of years. If a crop is lost through natural disaster or war and a seed bank is destroyed, a government could request replacement seeds from the vault. This according to The Guardian.
And according to the BBC, Afghanistan's intelligence services have angered Afghan journalists by distributing a list of restrictions on their reporting. The restrictions include directives not to represent the Afghan armed forces as weak or criticize the U.S.-led coalition. Many of the media see the move, which doesn't apply to foreign reporters, as an attempt to curb press freedom. The government denied it had issued any restrictions, merely a request for media not to glorify terrorism. The two-page document lays out an extraordinary list of demands for the Afghan media. Criticism of the U.S.-led coalition or NATO mission is banned, as is interviewing what it calls terrorist commanders, or even filming or photographing them. Representing the armed forces as weak is banned, as is publishing interviews against the government's foreign policies. Broadcasters have also been told not to put news of militant activities, such as suicide or roadside bombings, as lead story on bulletins.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, June 20th, 2006. Thanks for listening. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Our engineer is Steve. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Brian Smith.
We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in the Columbia River Gorge on Translator K246AA, and 100.7 in the Willamette Valley on Translator K220HR. If you would like to volunteer in the AM newsroom, call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202, or email at amnews@kbu.org. Portland area weather today, patchy morning clouds, mostly clear for the rest of the day, temperatures around 75 to 80. Tonight, cloudy along the coast, mostly clear inland, temperatures 45 to 50. And